Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
In 1954, in its September 6th edition, Life magazine published a 10-page photo essay on a remote corner of southern Utah. This was the work of two of America's most celebrated photographers, Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange. They had spent 3 weeks in Gunlock, Tocqueville, and St. George, and they created this rare and intimate portrait of an isolated, deeply rooted community that had begun to feel the pull of modernity. They took thousands of photographs. 35 made it into the piece. The magazine called it Three Mormon Towns. The art historian James Swenson says it was one of the most important collaborations in American photography, but he said the project began long before 1954. In fact, it was 20 years earlier, he says, when Dorothea Lange and her then-husband, the artist Maynard Dixon, made a trip to Zion National Park.
They hadn't really been to southwestern Utah at this point. And so they make this trip in which they bring their sons and they board them in Tocqueville. And Dorothea Lange photographs one of the original founders, a woman by the name of Marianne Savage, who was a plural wife to Levi Savage, one of the founders of Tocqueville. She chose to photograph Savage in profile. And you can see the wrinkles and age as it's represented on her face. Her hair has this beautiful wave and pattern to it that clearly was of interest to Lange. She's also wearing her canning apron. And if you've been around Utah in the summer, canning aprons were what women wore when they were canning. And so she's practical in that sense. But there's just this almost honor that Lange has in this photograph for this strong woman who would have seen just the hardships of what they saw as the frontier. I think that's, for me, the beginning of it. 1933, with that first visit.
The experience got Dorothea Lange thinking about wanting to photograph some of the other rural utopian communities in the country. She thought about the Amish and the Mennonites before she settled on the Mormons. She was interested in societies that were built on religious conviction and agrarian life, people who worked hard and held tightly to tradition. Now, Dorothea Lange usually worked alone, but this time she wanted to portray the people and the landscape where they lived, so she was going to need a partner. That's why she turned to Ansel Adams.
They had long wanted to work together. They both were strong advocates for photography and for the creative use of photography. And Dorothea, at least how they originally thought about it, was to photograph the people. Ansel was hoped could photograph the landscape and designs. They focused on everything from the Catholic Church billboard outside of town to the motel signs and street signs. Everything. I mean, these photographs show what St. George is in terms of population and its elevation, but also what it's becoming. A typical American town with Fords and appliances and JCPenney's. You're entering St. George, this town of the future.
James Swenson says Lange and Adams also managed to photograph something else in southern Utah, a place in motion. They weren't drawn to a community that was frozen in time. This was a place where the church was changing, the country was changing, and they understood a lot was at play, and they wanted to reveal that story. In fact, Swenson says the overriding theme of their project was the transformation of a Mormon village into an American town.
It is an interesting moment. on the one hand, you have Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams who want to celebrate the kind of rural, isolated Mormon hamlet. And yet at the same time, you have the church in 1953 that is wanting to see itself as just another part of American culture. And so you almost have these two competing ideas. And I think those two things do come into contrast and even conflict when Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange are in Southern Utah. I love these photographs. My favorites are probably the photographs of the children. There's a photograph of Kip Bowler, who's a young boy in Gunlock, and he's holding on to the side of his horse. There's no saddle. And he just has this just incredible smile as he peers over the back of the horse. There's also a beautiful photograph of a young boy selling peaches taken down low. The boy's face is obscured by the basket of peaches, and you just get a sense of what Utah was like. And I just really loved how these two great photographers were able to bring you there. They're trying to tell a story, and I think the reason why they resonate is that there's still just a sense of what it was like, what this place is, and the beauty and prose of these small Mormon cities.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about that Life magazine photo essay of these three Mormon towns. Also, we're talking about the collaboration of Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange. James Swenson has a book about all of this. It's called In a Rugged Land. We have a few photographs on our website, some of the images we're going to be talking about in the conversation. You can see them at radiowest.org. In the book, Swenson begins as Dorothea Lange and her family are crossing the border into Utah from Nevada. This is in the summer of 1953. He says she took a photo of that big neon cowboy sign that's still there now. Back then, the sign said, "This is the place." Swenson says it marked a new beginning for her.
This was her first opportunity to get back out in the field, really. She had a couple of other smaller opportunities. But in terms of being financed and supported by Life magazine, which was a big deal for them, And here's this opportunity. Get back out into the field. Come to a place that she knew, she had friends, and this is the place, right, for her to start again. She's brilliant as a photographer. She's ambitious. She's smart. And this presents this opportunity for her to begin again.
Let's, before we move on, I wanted you to help us sort of underline and explain the gifts and the reputation of Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange for those who don't really know. If the name is like, it's on the tip of my tongue, and we showed them a photograph of either of them, they would be there.
For sure.
But let's start with Dorothea. So you point out in the book that – so from like 1933 to 1944 or something like that, she's one of the most – Dorothea Lange. She's one of the most recognizable figures in photography. Talk about her reputation. And get us to that one extraordinary photograph that everyone will know, which is Migrant Mother.
Yeah. So Dorothea Lange, she's from New Jersey. She's Hoboken, right? And remarkably, she decides to be a photographer before she ever picks up a camera. So I think that says something about her. She just has this kind of iron will. She also, as a young woman, contracts polio, which leaves a kind of a visible limp. And she never fully gets over it physically, actually. Always wanted to come out west. She and a good friend decide to hitchhike around the world. They get as far as San Francisco, where they're pickpocketed. And that basically grounds Lange to the Bay Area, where she's going to spend the rest of her life. She meets Maynard Dixon, who's 20 years older than she is. They get married. They have two children. She runs a successful portrait studio. By 1933, their marriage is strained. The world seems to be strained, right? And right about that time, Dorothea starts to see – well, they actually have to save money. They board up the Suns, and they actually live in separate studios. And it's in her separate studio that Dorothea starts to see these wandering men, right, of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
She'll go out to the street. Again, it's this epiphanal moment where she'll go out and photograph – like the White Angel bread line is a photograph people might be familiar with.
Right.
And it's not long after that that she gets hired by the New Deal, originally by the Resettlement Administration and Roy Stryker. And later that's going to become the Farm Security Administration, the FSA, for which it's probably better known.
Yeah.
And it's while she's working with the RA that she makes in March of 1936, her most famous photograph. It's been argued it's the most famous photograph in the world.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it, even if they don't know Dorothea Lange. And it's that famous portrait of Florence Thompson, right? And her three children stuck basically in a frozen pea-picking camp in Nipomo, California, destitute, living out of a tent, right? Moving from camp to camp in search of survival, really. And so that image becomes instantly famous.
Yeah.
And instantly successful. It generates.
Why? Why do you think it? What is it? I mean, it's a. In some ways, it's not that extraordinary. There's something about it that captures, but it's just a photograph of a woman with her kids.
Yeah.
She has her hand interestingly placed on her, you know, face. And but what do you think it is?
That's a good question. That's a million-dollar question.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's a lot of scholars have tried tackling this. She takes about seven photographs, so she's kind of triangulating around this one family, right? And eventually that's the photograph that becomes the most famous. It's she's right up close.
Yeah.
The two children on the shoulder are facing the other direction. The baby, you can barely tell that there's a baby in her arms, but she does become, in fact, kind of this Madonna-like figure.
Mm.
The photograph is sometimes called the Migrant Madonna.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously just resonates with people. You know, if I want to get people to act, I'm going to use women and children as the thing that's going to pull at their hearts and really, you know, bring out this altruistic spirit. And it just works. She rushes the photograph up. Eventually it's published in the San Francisco News. And within two or three days, you know, with this call to help, you have tons of food sent down to Nipomo. But Florence and her family are already moved on to the next camp and don't even realize, right, that there's this image of them that's is going to be seen in museums. Museum of Modern Art buys it almost immediately. I mean, it's going to just begin its really rise to become this icon of not just of the Great Depression, but also of photography itself.
What do you think? How did she capture these photographs, or the people that she did? Did she create relationships with them? Did she keep her distance? Was it about lighting? Was it about the composition? Was it about all of those things? What was it, do you think?
I think it's all those things, you know, and probably 2 million other like factors.
And, yeah.
You know, she sees herself as what she calls the walking wounded. And that status of having this pronounced limp that came from polio, not only, she says, gave her this ability to kind of see pain in others, but it also made her vulnerable. And I think that enabled her to get right up to her subjects. She wasn't an opposing woman. She was short and I think all those things, and she was also using a Graflex for the most part. So holding her camera down kind of near her navel.
Mm.
And so she was able, just through talking and getting to know her subjects and just her persona, able to get up close and photograph people when they were ready for it, but also in those quiet moments where you might have a better chance of getting a photograph. Few people, I think, are as good as Dorothea Lange as photographing people as she is. And I think this is why, you know, she continues to have exhibitions and we continue to talk about her. And we continue to look at Migrant Mother and use it as an icon and spin it and parody it and keep it in the public eye. I mean, there's a reason why we haven't forgot her for all these decades.
So Ansel Adams, is there a photograph, a similar iconic photograph of his that people would recognize as the work of Ansel Adams?
You know, that's a good question. I grew up in an era which everyone seemed to know Ansel Adams. You know, he's on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
But I think in time, it's interesting. When I put this book together, they kept asking me, like, you know, most of the photographs seem to be Dorothea Lange, but why are you putting Ansel Adams first? And I think in my mind, like, everyone knows Ansel Adams. But I don't think that's as much as the case anymore.
Hmm.
And yet, I think anytime you see a photograph of the national parks.
Half Dome.
at Half Dome or Yosemite, right? Or an image of, say, the Watchtower in Zion National Park, where people are going to great lengths not to show that there's 5,000 other people standing next to them right behind them, or these, you know, 1,000 cars going by, where you're trying to capture this West as the most ideal, sublime thing that there is. Even if people don't know Ansel Adams, which I still kind of find hard to believe, but if, even if they don't know him, think of the 4.5 million people that are trying to make Ansel Adams-like images. He's still in our kind of public consciousness, even if he may, again, I can't believe I'm even saying this, may not be as recognizable as a name as somebody like maybe like Dorothea Lange.
So Dorothea Lange has been suffering from illness. She crosses the boundary between Nevada and Utah, looks at this project where she's headed as this new beginning. Where is Ansel Adams in terms of his career? He's at a low point, you mentioned.
Yeah, he's at a low point. So he has this decade or so, kind of right before World War II, even the years of, during World War II, where the government's basically sending him out to make these just incredible murals of the national park. You know, with a world at war, right, this is something we can rally around. Like, we've got this thing that we cannot lose. And so he makes these remarkable photographs of the national parks, and we'll be given the opportunity to go to national parks. He receives two Guggenheims, actually, to help support this. So he's kind of riding high. But then World War II comes, and he kind of struggles a bit. He doesn't know. He wants to be involved, but he's too old. And he just kind of finds himself just kind of wavering a little bit. The years after World War II, he gets commissions from Fortune, from a whole bunch of things that kind of keep him afloat. And he's got other projects. He's kind of always got something. He's extremely well-connected and active and energetic.
You say he never is at a loss for ideas. It's just he doesn't always have the money.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, and he has this driving idea that's supported by, you know, this tradition of American photography from Alfred Stieglitz and Paul Strand, and picked up by his best buddies, by his best friends Beaumont and Nancy Newhall, and particularly Nancy Newhall, who is, you know, really close with Ansel and one of his confidants, that photography is not just this thing, but it's this creative medium. And so he's really one of these standard bearers, you know, the torch bearers for this whole idea of creative photography. And so when he's having to do, you know, photograph Kennicott, for example, it's just not where his heart is, right? And so he's kind of wavering. He's feeling this kind of mid-career, midlife crisis. In fact, he's got a great quote, if you don't mind. He says this. He says, "I am pooped, peaked, and pallid, batty, busted, and brown, foolish, flagellant, and fatigued. I never felt more disorganized in my life," right? And I think any middle-aged man's like, oh, yeah, I can see some of those things too.
But,
but like, this is how he feels. I mean, and Ansel Adams, you know, he trained to be a concert pianist, transitions to photography. He's never lacked energy. And he's never lacked, you know, just these things that enable him to do what Ansel Adams can do. And I think, you know, end of the 40s, into the 50s, he's really struggling physically, financially, spiritually, in a sense, right? And I think he's needing a reboot just as much as Dorothea.
So we talked earlier about Dorothea's initial visit to the region in 1933. She's sort of enchanted by, the as you say in the book, the grandeur of Zion. And she and Maynard Dixon developed this real deep, it seems like a genuine affection and respect for the Latter-day Saints of that region. They were kind of a paradox, you say. There was something keep away, you know, stay apart, suspicious, but then also warm and welcoming. Like, what did they see in the people of that region?
Yeah, you know, that's good. So in 1933, Maynard talks to his good friend Conrad Buff, who's a great painter of the West. And Conrad's like, hey, you got to go check out Zion National Park. And so they load up the whole family. They make their way out. They actually board the two sons in Tokerville with someone, again, with the Nagel family that Lange's going to photograph later on when they come back in 53. And then they head off to Zion. And they're just overwhelmed by Zion National Park, especially for Maynard. It's Zion at night. And for Maynard, it's transformative, and he makes all these great canvases. actually, they're not that successful when he gets back to San Francisco, but they do become enamored with the place. And Maynard's going to come back, obviously, and build his studio in Mount Carmel. But as you mentioned, they're also – it's not just the landscape, but within this landscape, these pockets, these communities of just a paradoxical people, of these families that had been here for generations and eked an existence out of pretty – in some cases, quite difficult landscapes and yet thriving and – persevering. And in a rugged land, the title actually comes from what Maynard's going to say is like, these are remarkable people in a rugged landscape.
James Swenson, he's a professor of art history and the history of photography at Brigham Young University. His book is In a Rugged Land, Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and the Three Mormon Towns Collaboration. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1954, Life magazine published a 10-page photo essay about three small towns in southern Utah. It was the work of two of the country's best-known photographers, Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange. They spent 3 weeks embedded, basically, in Gunlock and Tocqueville and St. George. And today in the program, we're talking to the art historian James Swenson, who's written a book about the project. It's called In a Rugged Land. He says the collaboration helped capture a community on the brink of change. We have a few photographs from the series on our website if you want to see what Swenson is talking about. It's at radiowest.org. All right, so the other thing that's going on in this project is in terms of like transformation. So we're talking about these sort of careers that are at a turning point. But the LDS Church is at this turning point as well. And you write about it kind of being this period of transition. Here's how you put it in the book. You said it was a period of when a once outcast faith was increasingly seen as distinctly American and worthy of further inquiry. What do you mean? What's going on in the church right now?
Well, I think it's important to remember that after they get to Wendover, the first place they stop is Temple Square.
Yeah. Right?
They go to the administration offices. They meet with J. Reuben Clark. They had hoped to meet with Johnny Widsoe, but Johnny Widsoe had just passed
away. Now explain who that is for those who have no
idea.
Yeah.
So what they do is they realize that in order to do what they need to do, they need to get permission.
Yeah.
And permission has to come from Salt Lake. Everything starts and ends in Salt Lake if you're going to do something with an LDS, with a Latter-day Saint subject. And so Johnny Widsoe was a well-known apostle, actually was kind of well-known in academic circles, and a friend of Paul Taylor. So they had corresponded. They had similar interests, especially in like agriculture and agricultural communities. So they actually knew each other, and they were really hoping to meet with Johnny Widsoe. Johnny Widsoe was more open-minded to these kinds of things, they believed, and so...
So wait, the idea is we're going to pull into Salt Lake City, go to the executive office building or whatever,
yep,
and get the church leadership, yep, members of the First Presidency and the president to sign off on this.
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly. They had they actually had appointments set up. Johnny Widsoe wasn't able to. So they ended up meeting with J. Reuben Clark, who at that point was a member of the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And actually, Paul Taylor had met him years earlier in Mexico City. So they believed they had an in. But J. Reuben Clark was not going to be nearly as open as Johnny Widsoe.
He's suspicious.
Absolutely. The church had been burned before in his eyes by photographers and the photo press and things, and he was very leery of it. He gives them permission, right? Paul Taylor says, tacit approval was obviously given, But then, unbeknownst to them, he's going to call down to the stake presidents down in St. George, and basically, okay, keep an eye out. There's going to be people running around with cameras. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing, but keep an eye out, right? So
it was tacit approval. But this is a question that comes up later that Ansel Adams is really worried about. Like, did we ethically actually, you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's? Do they in fact know why we're down there?
You know, that's a good question. Right? Because being the diplomat that Paul Taylor was and as driven as Dorothy, I don't think they revealed all their hands when they meet with J. Reuben Clark.
Yeah.
In fact, I know they didn't. And that's going to come to a head when they get to Southern Utah. And they're like, we're making these photographs, and they're not really telling people why the photographs are being made.
Yeah.
They might go on exhibit in New York, right, where we are working for Life magazine, but not revealing that this is going to come out and be seen by more than half of the population of the United States, right? Which I think would be daunting for any community, but especially these small communities that, as you mentioned earlier, we're suspicious, right? We've been burned before, and so we are going to kind of be leery of this, right? But to your original question, the church at this time, and I think J. Reuben Clark is indicative of this, it's like they're wanting to grow. They're wanting to project themselves as quintessentially American, right? In fact, an important part of the quilt work of what the United States is, right? Yeah. That no longer this kind of outcast somewhere in the Great Basin, but now a part of and fully, you know, part of the parts of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to work hard at projecting themselves as, you know, being good Ford car purchasers and buyers of Sunbeam mixers and all the things, right? Fully participating in material culture and consumerism and all the things that make good Americans.
We're American.
Exactly. And coming out of World War II, we'd participate. Again, all the things, right, at this point that, you know what, just drive through Salt Lake. It's clean. It's nice. Yeah. It's American, right? Not this, you know, kind of strange foreign land that it really, especially coming out of the 19th century, was one of the things that we're always trying to overcome.
It's so interesting the notes that Dorothea Lange is taking as she's working through the state. She comes up with these themes that she has. She has this notebook with her. And I wrote some of these down. Pioneering never stops. Like, that's a big one for her.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to that, actually, because I think that's really important.
Oh, I agree. I think it's an underlying theme.
Right? Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Past and present.
Yeah. The glory of God is intelligence. Mm-hmm. Something that I think Latter-day Saints here will absolutely recognize that. Yeah. The saints are a peculiar people. She also writes that down. Like, what is she doing with that? How is that going to help her craft a photo essay for Life magazine, do you think?
Well, it's a good question. And I think it actually goes back to how Dorothea Lange worked as a photographer. Taylor is going to say that his wife's ear is just as good as her eye. And even during the Great Depression, she is writing down what she's hearing from these Okies on their way out to California. And some of the most remarkable, heart-wrenching, right, statements are coming not just by seeing the photographs, but also reading what they're saying. And those captions that work with the image and word and text and how they provide that extra layer of meaning and depth. So she's already well practiced at this. And so as she's going through Utah, she literally is scrabbling down these statements, but also scripture that's coming from people. They're getting to know the people. They're writing down what they're saying. They're figuring out how all these things are working together, knowing that they're going to have to craft a story to go on Life magazine. So again, text and image. Yeah, the idea of pioneering never stops. I mean, that could be a theme that goes through the entire series from Gunlock all the way through St. George.
Give me a sense of what a day was like. So they're down there for how long? How many weeks?
They're down there for about a couple weeks. They meet on August 10th.
Okay, so they get down there. And by the way, why in the hell did they go when it was so hot? Do you know what that was about? It's hot in Southern Utah in August.
And that's the thing, especially for someone like Lange who is already feeling it. I mean, Adams is like, you know, I don't know how she's staying on her feet. Yeah. I mean, she's just miserable. No. I think this is a word for everybody. Like, yeah, you don't want to be making a photo shoot in St. George in the middle of August. And it was hot. I mean,
But it looked hot, obviously.
Yeah, it looked
right?
Hot.
And I think that it gave a sense of it really underlined the idea of it being a rugged place, especially then.
And light does become something, especially for Lang, that's going to be a current all throughout what she does, right? I mean, if you look, for example, at Gunluck, it's seen through this dappled light, right? So, I mean, you know, through those the beautiful cottonwoods and all the other things, and in the evening, the kind of like evening glow. St. George is not spared anything, right? Just photographed in the middle of the day, hot asphalt, hot concrete, right? And so light does become an important topic, an important way of really a through line in connecting these and seeing it at different every time. So they meet on August 10th. Adams is coming from New Mexico. He's been working at Taos Pueblo project there. So he meets them. They stay at the Lee Motel, which is run by Juanita and her husband, Will Brooks. So literally they have Juanita Brooks there. So they can, I mean, this, think how great this would be. You get in, you're like, so Juanita, I don't know this about Mormons. Can you teach me something? And to have Juanita Brooks being your, basically your kind of on-site right, counsel. Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable. So they're there. They meet with the Chamber of Commerce. They try to placate bishops and all the things, right? Right. They're trying to do. And, in the middle of August too, they load up Ansel Adams' Cadillac wagon, put his camera on top and drive it right down the middle of St. George. So they're doing all sorts of things, in that too, 'cause they're very busy, but it's taxing in every way, especially on Dorothy Lang. And that's actually probably, I mean, she needed Paul Taylor there for multiple reasons. One was to just basically help her get through the day.
I want to just go through a couple of images. I know this is going to be difficult because this is radio. but let me just mention a couple that we could talk about. There's one, this weathered arm set up against some adobe. Will you talk about this image? Just sort of tell us what we're seeing and say something about this image.
Yeah. So they went from Gunluck to Tuckerville to St. George. The whole time probably photographing St. George because that's their base. And in St. George, this is where the paradox becomes the most obvious, in that you see St. George kind of wanting to push to the future, but at the same time still having those vestiges of its pioneering past. And they're going to find members of the community that are going to help them make this case. And one of the individuals they find, again, this would just be a block or two off of Highway 91, right, St. George Boulevard today. And it's a woman by the name of Ann Carter. And Ann Carter is the daughter of pioneers that, you know, her mom, Sophronia Turnbow Carter, was, you know, a third wife who drove the third wagon into St. George. So the rule of thirds here, right?
Yeah.
And so she, and actually when her mom comes into St. George, she comes in with, you know, cotton seeds, right, to plant cotton.
Wow.
And so she's going to photograph Carter holding in her hands some cotton seeds, right? Obviously a reference to the idea that Brigham Young was like, go down south, we're going to plant cotton, right? So she photographs a couple of rings, but the photograph you're referring to is a remarkable one where it's just the arm of Ann Carter. And this is most likely by Lang. I mean, you can kind of see, right? It's kind of hard sometimes to tell who was making what photograph because they'd just pass their camera between the two. But this is something that Lang would do all the time. She would use feet or hands really as metaphors or synecdoches of the whole thing, right? So here we see this hand, also obviously representative of this pioneering generation. The hand is clearly weathered, but it's also tanned, right? I mean, you can just, this older woman has been out in the sun. The freckles are there. But what's remarkable is the freckles also find parallel in the adobe brick, right? That's where she's putting her hand up next to it. And again, it's just that. It's just the hand, brick, and some crumbling mortar. I think the other part I love about this photograph is Lang's done her homework. There's a book she's read called Under Dixie's Sun, which had a compilation of just local histories and family histories and poetry. And there's a line in a poem by Anne Woodbury Hafen, who's a poet, called My Mother's Hand. And it starts out with flesh geography of the old frontier. And later on, it talks about how Hafen's mom's hand was a picture map of the Old West. And you can just see, right? I mean, Lang making these connections, seeing these things, and the flesh geography of the old frontier, right? Not seen in a landscape, not even seen in the architecture, but actually these hands that are connected to this pioneering tradition. And she's standing in front of Lange. Lange's taking her photograph, almost circling around her too, as she's done in other cases, to find the best image that sums up what she sees, what she's experiencing, and how to tell that story of this pioneering generation.
Okay, there's a photograph titled Main Street Full of Children, Gunlock, Utah, 1953. Couldn't be more ordinary in terms of a title. but describe it for us, because we see a good bit of this, like young people, children, you mentioned it before, on a dirt road, which happens to be Main Street, which is interesting. But say something about this photograph.
So this photograph comes during their work in Gunlock. St. George, for their team, is going to be, really the symbol of this LDS community that is almost now more American than anything else. And yet when they get to Gunlock and Tocqueville, much smaller, but actually in many ways just as old, if not older. Mm. And in Gunlock, it's the youth, particularly of the families. I mean, Gunlock is a small community. 87 people live there. Everyone looks like they've come out of a Norman Rockwell from the Saturday Evening Post.
You get a sense of freedom here. Here we have these three horses, and these kids are standing on top of them, goofing around.
Yeah, and so – yeah, exactly. And I was able to talk to a couple of the kids in these photographs, including Mary Ellen Hunt. They basically said this was a big deal, right? Not only – I mean, you just get a lot of people showing up in Gunlock. But when Ansel Adams pulls up in his Cadillac station wagon and opens this thing, and all of a sudden tripods start coming out and cameras start coming out, this is not the normal day in Gunlock.
Yeah.
And so they knew they were performing, getting on their horses, showing tricks. And the other thing I think it's important to mention with this is that Lange and Adams, but particularly Lange, was feeling as if the West was gone. Right, the West that she knew was leaving. So there's a heavy sense of nostalgia in these images for a more peaceful time, for a period in which, kids were playing on the street. She's not seeing this in Oakland anymore, right? She would have. And so there is a sense of loss in these images, and that there still are these places where, kids are just playing on their horses.
Let me ask about one more photograph. They're a series, actually, but The photographs that they took in Tocqueville in an LDS meeting house during what I presume is sacrament meeting, one in particular, the title is Church Service, Tocqueville, Utah, 1953, which is – for the life of me, it looks like a Norman Rockwell composed image. But it's just great. And then there's another one in your book. You've oriented it just below that. It's called Leaving Church, and it's the collection of women who have gathered in this same space. Say something about these particular ones, but also in general the images that they caught of people going to church.
Yeah. So one of the things they really were interested in is photographing church service. In Gunlock, Bishop Toby Hunt doesn't allow it. He's suspicious of it. Yeah. And he calls the stake president Reichman in St. George, and he's like, I don't know what to do. He calls Juanita Brooks, like, what do I do? Right. But Howard Fish is the bishop in Tocqueville. Taylor later on is just going to praise him. Like, we showed up, we asked, and he allowed us to do what we wanted. So they get permission to show up at church in Tocqueville. And you can actually see this in the photographs. They set up their tripod in between the podium and the stand, where you can see like the bishop and the high councilman and everything else, and then the congregation right behind them. They photograph the breaking of the bread. They photograph what was probably a high councilman thumping his fist on the pulpit, right? But the best images, the ones you're referring to, are what take place near the end. The tripod is still in the same spot, but they just turn it around. And so instead of seeing the podium and the sacrament table, you've got the congregation. And in the first image, remember, it's August in Tocqueville, and yet everyone's wearing their sport coats and their ties and their best patterned dresses, and they're singing right the concluding hymn here. But then they wait. And I think this actually reveals a lot about just how good they are, their instincts as photographers. And so the last image you refer to, the one underneath the one here, is that they photograph just the lingering, right? The light comes in, hits the top of the pews to create this beautiful pattern. If you look closely, though, you can see Howard Fish there at the door shaking everybody's hand. Just that sense of lingering and community. I mean, these families have been together in some cases for generations. They know each other's foibles. They know everything. And yet there still is the sense of being together.
James Swenson, he's a professor of art history and the history of photography at Brigham Young University. His book is In a Rugged Land, Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and the Three Mormon Towns Collaboration. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, we're discussing a Life magazine photo essay from the 1950s. It was a collaboration between Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams. They went to southern Utah to photograph three LDS communities, all of them still deeply rooted in tradition, even though change was starting to reshape their daily lives. We have with us the art historian James Swenson. His book is called In a Rugged Land. There's a kind of disappointing end to the project. It, as you write in the book, it becomes clouded in frustration and bitter disappointment. They didn't end up, Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange didn't end up getting along very well. It seems like
that's put it mildly.
Putting it mildly, yes. And also, you mentioned that it wasn't very long into the project, like a day or two, a couple of days, when Ansel Adams starts questioning the very nature of the work that they're actually doing. Something about it kind of irked him. He thought it was unethical that they hadn't. There's something going on there, and it's a bummer.
Yeah, it is, and that's the thing is, it's a bummer. But that actually benefited me because, you know, during the project, Ansel Adams is writing to Nancy Newell. I was like, this is great work. But then the same day, he's also – and actually, maybe I think it's two letters later, he's going to write to Nancy Newell and say, like, look, this is not a collaboration. Dorothea Lange's pushing me around. I'm sick of it, right? I mean, he gets – I love Ansel Adams, but he can get kind of gripey. he's like, yeah, I'm being manipulated. I'm being pushed around. I don't get what she's trying to do. She's not telling him the truth. There's an ethical part there, I think, that's part of the problem. I mean, Dorothea Lange was a strong-willed human being. Yeah. I mean, she's gonna say what she wants to say, and
she doesn't care if you're Ansel Adams.
No, she doesn't care. No, not at all. I mean, and that's the thing too. And I don't know if I mentioned this up front, but they're really close friends. They're collaborators. They're close friends. They sincerely love each other, but they are like people who see them together. Like, they should never work together, ever. Right? They're just so like they're both this kind of strong-willed, stubborn, and it just kind of starts to go south. The other thing that also made it kind of end in a whimper more than anything else is that they had high expectations that Life would just bring everything in, and like I don't know what they were expecting, to be honest. I mean, Life could never show all the photographs, could not give them that much space in the magazine. It's going to be a letdown. I mean, they take about 2,500 images. Life can only show a handful of them, right? And so they're just really kind of disappointed. And, you know, people back in Utah, some of them are going to be more disappointed than others, except people of gun luck. I think they're the only ones that
Life, this is great.
Yeah, they're the only ones, I think, that actually, like, came out of this looking good. But
what did they think outside of the people in gun luck thinking, oh, this, you know, this is kind of great. But you mentioned in the book that they felt exposed, that they possibly, some of them anyway, thought they were manipulated. We'll get to what J. Reuben Clark thought here in a minute. But what did the people there think about what?
Well, so that's goes back to what we mentioned earlier, is that they weren't forthright on what they were doing.
Yeah.
Right. And so that is, I think, ethically, that's
a problem.
That's a huge problem. That's a huge problem with any photographer, right? And especially, you know, by mid-century, photographer's like, life, like, you got to tell us their names. You got, like, we got to have permissions. You got to, you know, that's starting to happen as well.
Right.
And so, like, Lang and Adams have never worked with that, right? So they're just photographing. But the worst part is that they're not revealing that, okay, this is probably going to show up in Life magazine. It's going to show up on your neighbor's front porch, right? And so when it comes out, Gundlach is painted as this youthful, vibrant, just beautiful community. And if you look at the photographs, they're going to emphasize kids on horses and all the beautiful things about it. Tocqueville is shown, in fact, and described as a city in decay. And the other problem is, too, is you have individuals like Vera Beatty, who Lang and Adams photographed a number of times. Famously, she didn't have time to do her hair, and she's in the photograph, she's wearing her canning apron. It's canning season. And so she's not presented as she wants to, but she's got these photographers showing up like, okay, now go up to your window of your red brick house, and now let's photograph you in front of this old pioneer home. The Beattys have been around Tocqueville for a long time, and yet here you have Vera Beatty, who now is showing up in Life magazine with tussled hair.
And she should be in her Sunday best.
Exactly. I mean, you notice any grandmother would be like, you're not photographing me like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And she could have quit. And it's Vera Beatty who's going to write to Dorothy Lang and Paul Taylor saying, look, you were not honest with us. We're mad. In fact, she basically, not a veiled threat, she threatens, like, don't come back to town because if you do, we're waiting for you. And what's interesting about this is when I went back to Tocqueville, there still is that hurt. I mean, I talk to people who are like, yeah, we were all mad. I mean, kids back in 1953, right? The paper boy, Mike Nagel, for example, was like, yeah, we were mad. We were mad at how we were represented. We were represented in a way that did not represent how we saw ourselves. And actually, if you look at the overall rights record, photographic record, Tocqueville is not that much old. In fact, it's rather vibrant if you look at the photographs that exist. So
how are we supposed to now look at this project that had, as you say, so much promise, but comes to kind of a sour, as you said, whimper of an end? The big question is, did they in the end, Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lang, did they manage to capture the spirit of these Mormon communities? And you write about what you call the insight of a photographer and whether they're able to capture something, I don't know, genuine or real beyond just the kind of material, physical thing that they're capturing. And you quote the Trappist monk, Father Thomas Keating, and he says, is the function of the art of photography to preserve the artist's moment of insight or simply let reality speak for itself? Perhaps it is not for the photographer to reply, but to open himself and to present his lens to the light. So what do you think? Did with all of that in mind, with the insight that they had, even the defensive reaction from some of the people they captured and the leadership of the LDS Church, did they get the spirit of that community?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'll be honest, I still think I'm grappling with this question. I got to the last chapter of this, and I realized I had a slew of just beautiful photographs of a religion, right? And that's what they were pursuing, right? They wanted to show the St. George Temple and the Tabernacle and all that. Like, if they're going to photograph, as they did, a hymn book, it's going to be open to Come, Come, Ye Saints,
right?
Of course, right? I mean, it's this as this anthem. So they knew what to look for. They knew what these, you know, visible symbols of Mormonism is. But, like, is it more than that, right?
Yeah.
And is it just this ism, or is it something else? And so photographing a religion is different than photographing a faith. But I will say this. This book now has been out for a number of years. And I get a lot of people come up even now and talk to me about the photographs, both inside of the church, outside of the church, and everything in between. And especially early on, I get letters saying, you know what, I've moved to Utah. I don't know if I get what's going on here. But I'm glad I read this book, and I think it helped me a little bit. And so when you get things like that, I'm like, all right, maybe there was something that captures some of the essence of this. Then I'll hear from members of the church and say, you know what, this photograph really spoke to me. Not just because I grew up here, but this is a photograph of something that is deeply meaning to me and that it's not just a pretty photograph, but there's something else to it. So I think in reality, what I was trying to do with this project is the photographs were so good, I can't screw them up, right? But to be able to frame some of these questions and to be able to ask a bigger question like that was a real opportunity. And this, I even just returning to this project, I'm like, oh, this was a good project.
James Swenson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Swenson, he's a professor of art history and the history of photography at Brigham Young University. His book is In a Rugged Land, Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and the Three Mormon Towns Collaboration. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1, and you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Special thanks, by the way, to Nancy Green. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.